one of the things that helped the Germans was their reserve system. Brilliant system. Kept the nation's men completely focused on service to their country. All right. French Army. What can we say about the French Army? Well, the French Army, French also had a large standing army, but not as large as the German standing force. The French army was large, but it was not as formidable as the German forces. Germans, and I'm not exaggerating, were the best trained, the best commanded, the best armed of all of the armies in 1914. The French, not so much. Now, they knew war was coming. They could predict it. They had a feeling it was coming. So in 1913, in preparation for the war, they actually added a year's service. So if you were in France and you got called to arms, you would be expected to serve 3 years. So that did help. That actually increased their fighting force by 1914 by about 50%. But they had a smaller population. The German population was about 65 million. French population was about 40 million. That in part is one of the reasons why, even though the army was about 800,000, about the same size as the Germans, that number was about 85% of fighting age males. They basically tapped out their abilities right out of the gates. Whereas Germans 800,000, that was only about 50% of those fighting years. So they could double the army if there was a need. And they had the means to do so. Now, the French did have a reserve system. They had about 2.8 million reservists. But unlike the Germans, who while in the reserves continued their training, the French were just kind of like reservists in name only. So even the French high command doubted the abilities of their reservists. Another problem the French had, they were dependent on purchasing munitions. French industry was incapable of supporting an army if there was a protracted war. So to put it another way, every single bullet that was fired was not necessarily replaceable with another bullet. 1913 military estimates had it for every 3 bullets that were fired, French industry may be able to replace 2. So the problem is eventually if you continue to fight day after day after day, week after week, year after year, long protracted war, you're going to run out of your ability to fight. German capacity? They had capacity to spare. They were continuing to produce civilian products all the way up until 1916. They didn't need to switch their entire industrial capacity over to the war setting. So one bullet, one replacement. But the French did have one advantage. Hands down, they had one of the best artillery pieces in the entire war. And they had lots of them. They were utilizing the French 75mm cannon. Not that you need to remember this detail for the exam, but it had a maximum range of 6.8 miles. It could fire 2 types of rounds without putting a new barrel on there. It had the ability to fire a 12-pound impact detonated shell, or they could fire a 16-pound diffused shrapnel shell. And a well-trained crew could fire about 30 rounds per minute because it was a breech-loading gun. So you pull the round, the pin, it fires it, pop open the back, remove the shell, put the new shell in. Boom, 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 boom. That's what we're talking about. The French had 4,000 of these when the war started. As far as their standard issue weapons, well, they were okay. But each one of these had flaws. The standard issue rifle was a LaBelle Model 1886. It was a bolt action rifle. So like the Gewehr, there's the bolt right there. So you lift the handle up, you pull it back, you open up the breech, you put your round in, close it, fire. Once you get it loaded, you fire, open the breech, you discharge the round, and go to the next bullet. So about everybody had breech-loading rifles. But the weird thing, bizarre, about the LaBelle was how the rounds loaded. The Gewehr had a 5-round box, so you could use your stripper clip and you could push them inside the gun top down. The LaBelle, you individually hand-fed 8 rounds into an inner tube that went underneath the barrel. And as you can see, the bullets went in tip to firing pin. Tip to firing pin. So if you pushed your round in too far, it would detonate the bullet in front of it. And you could cause your gun to blow up in your hands. So the French had to load it very slowly to make sure that the tip was either up or down before putting the next round in. Whereas the Gewehr platform, again, same base as a K98, that's what I have. You open it up, you have your 5 bullets, it takes seconds. Close it up, there you go. They also issued a revolver as opposed to a semi-automatic sidearm. The French soldiers that had it, they had a MAS, it's a MAS 1873, fired 11mm round. It's a 6-round cylinder. But again, weird loading. Unlike most revolvers where you can basically open out the carriage or you can do a breech and gain access to it, there's actually a trap door on the side. So similarly, you opened up and you had to put one in at a time. And for some reason, there was no complete carousel extractor mechanism. So you had to pull out this little pin, open up the side door, and you could use this to go in and grab the cartridge, the spent cartridge. So you had to carefully pull out each one and then manually reload it. Stupid design that just took up time. Whereas if you had a Luger or one of the other, the Brum Mausers, you just had a magazine. You could just slap right in. And their machine gun. They utilized a Hotchkiss M1909 Benet Maurice machine gun. No other European power adopted this rifle. Everybody else had a Maxim gun. Belt-fed, water-cooled. This was a gas-cooled rifle. Gas operated, rather, air cooled, and it had stripper belts that had 30 rounds in it. So, as this picture shows, you're sitting there holding the machine gun, you put this 30-round cartridge in, and you pull the trigger, God forbid the bullets aren't placed in this chassis properly, because it would jam, or if there's any grime that gets into it, forget about it, you're done. Technically, it had a 600 round per minute capacity, but they were pretty much useless. I think the jam rate was something like 50% of every belt that you tried feeding in. So imagine you're in the middle of the battle, the enemy's coming across no man's land, and you're like, hold on, I'm jammed. Yeah, it's not going to work. Not going to work. So what does that do? That reduces the effectiveness of the French units. Through no fault of the soldiers, but through their munitions, their weapons. Russian army. The Russian army was huge. The largest peacetime standing force on Earth. When the war started, they had 1.5 million men. Active duty. Largest peacetime force on Earth. And there's many things you can knock the Russian army about, but I'll give them credit. They were well organized by 1914. Due to the embarrassment that they suffered at the hand of the Japanese, Russian military leaders began really modernizing their military force. Their army was divided into specialized units that each had a particular purpose. So there was infantry, there were snipers, there were cavalry. And because Russia was a supranationalist nation, they also divided their army by nationality. So you had Siberians, you had Turkestanis, you had Cossacks, you had Finnish soldiers. The advantage of this is you could have a commanding officer in charge of the unit that could speak to the men. We got that, okay. They also had the largest pool of men to tap. In addition to the 1.5 active duty, they had 1.6 million reservists that could be mobilized relatively quickly. Plus, in terms of fighting age men, 17 to 45, Russia had another 22 million or so that they could tap if they needed to engage in total mobilization. They literally had the ability to muster the largest fighting force on Earth. And, interestingly enough, because of their manpower, that would be the primary tactic used by the Russians. They had what they was referred to as a steamroller army. Their strikes would literally be based upon overwhelming the enemy. And that's why on the Eastern Front, even though the Russians would end up getting their butts whipped, they were able to fight the Germans, the Austrians, and the Ottomans simultaneously. Because they could just put wave after wave of body onto the field. As far as weapons go, very effective. Very effective. The elite units were issued a Mosin Nagant, which fired a 7.62 by 38 millimeter round. It's a bolt action rifle, similar to the Gewehr. It had a found 5-round box in it. Basic. Simplistic, but you can beat the piss out of these guns and they'll still fire. In fact, that's one of the reasons why the Mosin Nagants are still in operation on the battlefield today. Russia continued to make them all the way up until 1973. I think there's something like 50 million of them out there, just because you can't kill them. Like the Gavari, it had a stripper clip. Maximum range, about 1.5 miles, rather. Good soldier, could get off 15 rounds per minute. And I was watching a video, and I got a chuckle. There are Ukrainians fighting against the Russians that have Mosin Nagants. Because again, you can't kill them. You cannot kill them. They're like all of the Russian basic weapons. The SKS, the AK-47 platforms. They're designed to be simple, but you can fill them full of grime and gook and throw them through the mud, and they'll still fire. Very reliable. But again, only the elite units got this rifle. Because one of the biggest problems the Russians had was they had more men than actual rifles. So chances are they would be ethnic Russians that got this, whereas the ethnic minorities probably would get some of the secondary weapons. Same thing on sidearms. There's about a dozen that were distributed throughout the Russian army, but the most common was a single-action revolver. Single action. So you pull the firing pin back, then you pull the trigger. Cock it and fire. Cock it and fire. It's not a double action. It's not once you cock it, you can just pull the trigger and go, go, go. Seven rounds. Good gun, but it had a hard trigger. About 12 pounds of force necessary to pull the trigger. And like the French sidearm, real pain in the ass to reload. Same thing. You had to manually pull out the spent cartridge through a side door and kind of put in one round at a time. So usually it was the officers that had the sidearms. And typically, once they fired the seven rounds, they'd probably throw the gun like a club and then pick up another one instead of taking time to reload it. Firearms, machine gun, they adopted a Maxim. Like the Germans, belt fed, about 400 to 500 rounds per minute, water cooled. But these were manufactured not to fire the 8mm rounds of the Germans, but rather the cheaper 7.62 Russian rounds. But whereas the Germans had a 4-man crew that would break down and be responsible for moving it, the Russians largely put their machine guns on wheeled carriages to make them easier to move. And they did have a decent field piece. 76mm divisional gun, M1902. Could fire about 12 rounds per minute with a well-trained crew, but it only had a maximum range of about 5.28 miles. But they were light, they were easy to operate, and ironically, a lot of the guns that would be captured by the Germans would be reused. Except what the Germans would do is they'd just rebore it and put the German 77mm round capability. But the guns saw action throughout all of World War I and limited use in World War II. Decent. But despite the numbers, despite the fact that overall they had pretty okay guns, weapons, the Russian army had three huge flaws which the Russians could never overcome. One, they had no factories. So their quantities of military stores ran out. Their industrial complex completely backwards. For example, when Russia started in World War I, they had their 1.5 million men, they called in their reserves, they opened up a draft. They managed to, by the end of 1914, going into 1915, have about 6 million men in uniform. But they only had 4.6 million rifles to total. And of those 4.6 million rifles, there were 20 different types in there, including Japanese captures, French rifles, Swiss rifles. Hell, they even had some American surplus black powder rifles from the Civil War. What's the problem if you have one army and you have 20 different types of guns out there?
Let's just base an ammunition become a pain.
Yeah, why?
You have to supply different types of ammunition for the weapons.
Oh, you mean all guns don't fire the same bullets?
Nope.
No. So every single unit that had different guns in them, the only way they could use the guns is if they could get the ammunition for those particular guns. And every round is different. So there were battles where literally the Russian soldiers were told to affix bayonets and to charge at the German machine guns with their bayonets or spears, bows and arrows, swords, whatever they could get their hands on, because there were no bullets. While the Germans simply sat back and went, second problem. In the entire Empire of Russia, the Russian army only had 670 motorized vehicles. 670. That includes locomotives. Plus, they had about 1/10 of the railroad lines as Germany. So what does this mean? Well, their men had to march everywhere. There was no choice because there were no trucks, no trains. Lastly, in the army, there were 17 different languages that were spoken. So while it was possible to put someone who spoke that language as commanding officer of the unit, think of the high command. Every single order had to be issued in 17 different languages. Where could you run into problems with that?
Battlefield.
Because how many different ways can you say go before you lose it in translation? Charge, retreat. You know, some of those words don't necessarily always translate cleanly, let alone when you're going to give complex orders. If you don't speak another language other than English, even if you are bilingual, you cannot directly easily translate a word from English to Spanish or vice versa, because the words don't translate. But now trying to translate something into 17 different languages? Yeah. So it's great that you're going to have this steamroller effect, but it is what it is. Questions? And these are not in any particular order, although I did start off with the Germans first because the Germans were the best. Next up is the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Whereas the Russians were the biggest, the Austrians were the smallest. In 1914, they only had in their standing army 450,000 men. Half the size of the Germans. Third of the size of the Russians. And they also had the smallest reserves. They only had about 1.2 million reservists. So not a lot of men. But their soldiers, were almost as well trained as the Germans, because their organization was very similar to what the Germans utilized. Meaning, you had the active duties, you had the reservists, they were expected to spend, 10 years in the reserves, you also had the local militias. The Austrians borrowed all of that. But again, there's just not a lot of them. their standard issue weapons, adequate. The standard issue rifle was actually a clone of the Gewehr 98 rifle used by the Germans. They used the Steyr model 1912 Mauser. Same basic firing operating system, bolt action, 5-round box, fed by stripper clips. The only difference was that it was a little shorter and it fired a smaller round. But of course, you can see they also used the C90s as the standard sidearm. There were very few, if any, Lugers that were used. Decent. Their soldiers were well armed. They could fight very well. Unfortunately, the area where they were the weakest was in artillery. They had the smallest artillery capacity out of all of the major combatants. And the biggest flaw that they had was that their guns were antiquated. Two-thirds of their artillery divisions used 8-centimeter field cannon, an M5, this gun right there. That gun was made in the 1860s, and it was made out of cast bronze, not iron. What's the difference between a steel gun and a bronze gun?
Bronze will break easier than iron.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same capacity in terms of use. So if you fire and fire and fire, a bronze gun is likely going to crack, because it doesn't handle the heat. It expands quickly and then it cools, it shrinks and it cracks. The guns, because they were bronze, not steel, were also very heavy. So it was a pain in the ass to move them. And they fired the smallest round. They fired a 76 millimeter round, whereas the Germans were using 77 millimeter rounds. The end result, you only could get off about 10 rounds per minute. Not that good. In a maximum range, only about 4 miles. Even the Russian guns were longer in range than what the Austrians could field. The other third of their guns were the obsolete M99 field Hauptspitzes, field howitzer. Also made out of cast bronze, not steel. And the worst part is that gun had no recoil mechanism. So you put it on your platform, you fire it, the gun, because of physics, is going to move. And the moment it moves, you have to take the time to reposition it, rezone it in. No armored protection or plate for the guys who fired it. There was that plate there, but it couldn't even repel standard issue rounds from rifles. Just go right through it like butter. So the crews pretty much fired it and had to duck. And if they came under enemy fire, forget about it. And it was heavy. It weighed over 2,200 pounds. So fire it, boom. Have to move it back into position. Have to re-aim it, redo everything. FYI, the Serbians, they fired a 150-millimeter howitzer that had twice the range. So one of the big advantages, disadvantages that we're going to see is when the Austrians charge over the Serbian borders, the Serbs were able to quickly repel them because they had better guns. Other flaws, diversity. The units were organized based on the provinces that they came from. But unlike Russia, where there were clear ethnic groups that came from provinces, because of the mixing of ethnicities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Yeah, you could have a unit that came from, say, Slovakia, but that didn't mean you had a unit of just Slovaks. So within each unit, there were different ethnic groups. So, how did the Austrians compensate? Well, because the majority of the regiments had 3, 4, 5 languages spoken within it, each soldier was expected to learn 80 words in the common language of the unit. So, if it was a German unit, even if you were a Slav, you had to learn at least 80 commands in German. If you were a Hungarian unit, Hungarian would be the primary language. Or if it was like Croatian, well, whatever the majority language is, that would be the language that was spoken. And everyone else have to use those 80 command words. So they know how to come to attention. They knew how to stand at ease. They knew how to fire. Things like that. And as if that's not bad, that's not worse, this is hands down the most atrocious. Austria-Hungary was never a rich nation. Training costs money. Let alone money for ammunition and equipment to move the troops or to fix things that break or to provide food or fuel. Money is necessary. So the moment the war started, there was little to no money kicking around. So one of the first things the Austrians began doing was cost-cutting measures. And the one thing that they cut out was training. So the Austrian soldiers, they could drill. They knew how to march in formation. But you know what they didn't know? First aid. You know what they didn't know? They didn't know how to fire over long distances. You know what they didn't know? How to keep your cool through simulated live fire. So imagine these poor guys. They have no idea what the fuck they're doing. But they get thrown out onto the battlefield. So out of all the armies, the individual Austrian soldier was the least prepared for what would happen. And that's one of the reasons why, by 1917, the Austrian army pretty much imploded. The Germans had to take over.
Last but not least, the Brits.
The British army in 1914 was almost oxymoronic. It's very bizarre when you really look into it. It simultaneously was very modern, but you could also see ancient elements that dated back to the 18th and 19th centuries. It was weird. On one hand, highly professional army, well trained, but small. England had the largest empire on earth. In terms of military capacity, they only had about 700,000 men in 1914. And this was not an army that was made for a European protracted war. Rather, it was more like different units of Marines. The idea was rapid mobilization. So, the main strength was its logistical abilities. The soldiers could trust that they would be quickly put into position where they needed to be. They could trust that the supply stream would remain constant, and they could count on rapid medical service. But again, 700,000 men stretched out globally. But they also had a huge advantage that no one else had. The fact that they had the largest empire on earth. when push came to shove, they could actually draw on soldiers from anywhere in their empire. On the Western Front, as we're going to see, there would be Australianders, there would be New Zealanders, there would be sepoys, Indian soldiers, soldiers from India deployed. There would be Afrikaners, there would be Newfoundlanders, there would even be Canadians, in addition to the Scots, the Irish, the Welsh. By 1918, they would have deployed over 9 million men in uniform. But unlike all of the other armies, which are armies in the modern sense of armies, truth be told, the design of the British force was more like a police force. And it was the same type of structure that they've utilized throughout the entire 100 preceding years. The last time they had an army in an army sense was probably during the Napoleonic Wars. Instead, it was small units that you could quickly put on a ship and move it to where anywhere on earth you needed it. They also had an officer corps, but probably one of the most ancient elements or antique elements of the British Army was their officer corps. In Germany, you became an officer regardless of your birthright. Yes, we're going to see lots of Vons, you know, Prussian nobles, but they didn't get into the military academies because of their family. They got into the military academies because of their skills, their merit. In England, if you were a noble, you were coming in at a lieutenant, regardless of your actual ability. So your name is what got you the gig, not your actual abilities. So what does that mean? Well, birthright is great. But if you have the right last name and you get a prestigious command, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be effective on the battlefield. Plus, if you were a noble, you could be in the cavalry. Whereas if you were a commoner, you could not. Again, just because you're a noble, does that mean you can ride a horse better than somebody else? Not necessarily, but it didn't matter. Another interesting flaw, the high-skilled units, artillery, engineers, they actually had class dependency. If you were poor, you were denied access to go into the British Corps of Army Engineers. You had to prove that you were at least come from a middle-class family. Again, I get a chuckle out of that because just because you're poor, that doesn't mean you're dumb. In fact, chances are if you're poor and you actually know some stuff, you probably know it better than someone who came from the particular family that spoke the right accent because they went to the right polo grounds and had tea at proper time. And to make things even worse, unlike any other of the armies, the British Army was fighting the last war. Not the current war, not the future war, but the last war. The last war that they fought was in South Africa against the Boers, against the Zulu, and the Dervish. Most of the British leaders didn't trust the new technology. Instead, they focused on the tactics that would allow them to win the Boer Wars. They literally brought back the cavalry, including the reintroduction of standard issue lances in 1910. So, You have the Germans on the other side with their Maxim machine guns ready to go. And, ooh, let's get on our horse and let's charge the enemy. That's brilliant. Officer training focused on tough tests of character, not any actual skill. They believed that if the soldiers were brave enough, that would be enough to help them win the day. Again, it's tired, it's cliche, but 400 to 500 rounds a minute. I don't care how much honor and prestige your family has. Good luck with that. But when the soldiers actually went into the battlefield, they did actually have the latest weapons. The British infantry was actually armed standard issue with the second most widely used military rifle of the entire 20th century. They went into battle with the Lee Enfield Mark III. It was a box magazine bolt action rifle capable of holding 10 rounds, double the capacity of the German rifle. It fired the British 303 and a well-trained British soldier could fire off this 10 rounds and with his stripper clips get 20 to 30 more rounds into the box. The highest rate of fire was 35 rounds per minute, which isn't that bad. Pull the trigger, bolt reload. The Lee Enfield had an effective range of 1.7 miles. The Brits also used what they called a Vickers gun, which is basically a Maxim gun. Same rate of fire, about 400 to 500 rounds per minute. Like the Germans, they didn't have it on a wheel carriage like the Russians did, rather, but like the Germans, there was usually a firing crew of 3 to 4 men that could assemble it, break it down, and put it to use. Belt-fed, water-cooled. Their sidearm, again, basic revolver, but unlike what the enemy had, theirs, you could actually open up the breech and basically with an extractor button, pop out all 6 shells at once, fit them all in, lock it closed, and fire. And in terms of ordnance, they fired the QF 18-pounder gun. This was, out of all the artillery field pieces, this had the largest round, 84 millimeter. Each round weighed about 18 pounds. A good, well-trained crew could get about 20 rounds per minute. And it had a decent firing range, maximum firing range about 9,300 yards. And the Brits had about 1,100 on hand at the start of the war. So their flaw was in leadership. But at least these soldiers, once they got into the field, you know, they were armed well. Questions? So again, pros and cons, advantages, disadvantages, all stuff that would be exposed on the battlefields of 1914. But the biggest thing that would be exposed was the strategies, the battle plans. Now let's be honest, in order to win a war, you have to have strategy. But unfortunately, the moment World War I would erupt, all of the plans that were developed by staffs over the preceding 20 years, the moment the first round was fired, they pretty much were proven to be obsolete. So what ended up happening as the war went on, the strategic plans were often replaced by political goals. You know, we have to take this city so the elected official can get reelected, kind of deal, as opposed to actually being able to strategically take the position. The truth of the matter is that past experience became quickly thrown out the window in World War I. World War I was a war unlike any the world had seen before. There was no comparison. So all of the past experience quickly became irrelevant. And two, like I said, political goals, as often is the case, they're unattainable. Because wars don't follow plans. Wars just unfold. And as World War I would unfold, to say it was unforeseeable the outcome, that's an understatement. The biggest problem was it became a defensive war. But it wasn't a defensive war by design. No. It was a defensive war that would evolve out of necessity. In 1914, every single nation was part of what military strategists refer to as the cult of the offensive. Meaning, they believed they could achieve superiority on the battlefield by pounding the enemy offensively. So, again, you could send wave after wave at the enemy, and eventually you will win. But the problem is they didn't apply the military, technological, and material capacity onto the battlefield. They didn't understand that attacking entrenched machine guns positions was not a good thing when you're racing across an open field. But again, it wasn't one side. So the architect of Germany's initial plan, Field Marshal Alfred Graf von Schlieffen, he, in his Schlieffen plan, literally spelled out this phrase, attack is the best defense. So don't retreat, just attack. The Brit officers, like I said, I'm not exaggerating. They were literally taught that even thinking of defenses, that's unmanly. Because only cowards worried about defending. No. You charge the enemy. Commanding officer of the French army at the beginning, Field Marshal Joseph Joffre, he actually claimed that his army, and I quote, knew no other law than offense. How did that work out for the Lions? Complicating things were the plans. This is what was actually laid out on paper. I'm only going to give you three examples. First, German perspective. Beginning in 1905, the German high command began formulating plans for what they rightfully perceived as the inevitable. Germany was, whether they liked it or not, was going to fight a two-front war because France was over here and Russia was over there. There was no way around it. So, the best way to counter a two-front war is to quickly make it a one-front war. So, the plan that would actually be put in motion in 1905 was drafted by the aforementioned Field Marshal Alfred Graf von Schlieffen in what is known as the Schlieffen Plan of 1905. Schlieffen decided that the way they would win a two-front war is essentially by knocking the French out first, because the French had a smaller army than the Russians. According to his timetables, it would only take 6 weeks. You know why? Because that's about how long it took the Prussians to do it in the Franco-Prussian War. But under the Schlieffen Plan, whereas in the Franco-Prussian War, all of the penetration came through Alsace and Lorraine, and then the German forces did one of these, Schlieffen actually planned on using the neutral country of Belgium, and the intent was to launch simultaneously five armies in a sweeping move that the first army in particular would get to the coast, sweep beyond Paris, and just like it had happened in the Franco-Prussian War, that essentially encircle the capital city, and the French would be begging for surrender, because that's what the French did in 1871. So because it worked then, of course it's going to work again, because the French are good at surrendering. But the problem is you're invading another country. Why Belgium? Well, Belgium was flat. Along the southern sector, there's dense forests and mountainous terrain. So Schlieffen basically said, because the German army controls the railroads, the German army would not have to march, but rather could come in and build railroad lines and basically cross across Belgium. And again, in this massive penetration, penetrate all of northern France before the French could do anything. Why? Well, Schlieffen believed that the French, they would hide behind their city fortresses. They would try fighting a static war. Because going all the way back to the Franco-Prussian War, the French had slowly begun building up a bunch of fortified cities. So under the Schlieffen Plan, you just go around them. Leave the French in their little castles, and we'll take the rest of the country. But again, the key is rapid mobilization. Attack, attack, attack. And then, once the French surrender, you can take all the German forces, send them quickly across Germany, and fight on the Eastern Front. 100% brilliant plan. Brilliant plan. But they made three big mistakes, one of which we already covered. The moment they declared they were going through Belgium, as they designed in their plan, that's what brought England in. Because Belgium was a neutral country. They asked the Belgians said no, so the Germans said go pound sand. Huge mistake. They didn't fear what the Belgians would do. Second, they didn't take into account, do they have enough men and bullets right out of the gates to win in 6 weeks and then quickly redeploy? What would actually end up happening is in the first month or two of World War I, Germany began actually running low on bullets. They had factories, the bullets could be replaced, but it takes time. It's a good idea, but not quite there. The French plan was just plain out ridiculous. Their focus was getting revenge for the Franco-Prussian War. Their primary plan, developed in 1913, is the infamous Plan 17 that was drafted by Field Marshal Joseph Jacques Césaire Joffre. Joffre's plan was literally based on the Franco-Prussian War. He believed that just as they did in 1870, Germany would concentrate all of its strength in the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine. Down here, those provinces that they took in the Franco-Prussian War. And what the French would need to do is maximize their efforts and penetrate through this region and get to the Rhine River. They believed that they could knock out the German army essentially in a 1-2 punch. The moment the lines were penetrated, that it would be a traditional 19th century war. That Alsace and Lorraine would be occupied, and that would be the basis of negotiations. And they believed the war could be over within 2 months. Not because of victory, but because the Germans, so terrified at how quickly that they would lose Alsace and Lorraine, that they would want to negotiate in hopes of keeping one of the two. But this was risky. Why? Well, because in order for his plan to work, all of the German strength had to be here, and the French had to be able to cut through the Germans like a hot knife through butter. Because obviously, it would be easy to beat the Germans. I'm being sarcastic. 100% sarcastic. Because there's no basis for reality on this. You can't assume that your enemy is just going to roll over. Particularly when the German track record to this point has been nothing but success. But why did they think that the Germans would negotiate quick? What did they do in Morocco? Not once, but twice. They quickly negotiated. So Joffrey's like, well, we did it. We scared him once. We'll scare him again. Out of all of the pre-plans, the Brits was the most realistic, and it should have served as a warning sign as to what would come. The best way to describe England's pre-war plan is as they themselves described it. Business as usual. The only comparison I can make is what George W. Bush said after 9/11 when boots were deployed in Afghanistan and into Iraq. He literally went on TV and told the American people not to volunteer, not to sign up, not to make a sacrifice for the country. No, you know what he literally said? Go shopping. That's the best thing you can do for the economy. Go shopping. I remember sitting back saying, what the fuck? How is my going down to Walmart and getting a carton of eggs going to help the war effort out? But that's what the President of the United States said. And by the way, that's what the British leaders said in 1914. Their plan was, do nothing different. Their plan was, we're going to continue to make sure that our global empire and our economy continue to hum. So the politicians never talked about sacrifices. But rather they told the donating class, the industrialists, the financiers, yeah, this war, it's going to be a quick little fun little war in the continent. But our empire is secure. We have nothing to worry about. So that's one of the reasons why, under British plans, they were not going to fully commit their strength. Instead, they planned on sending over some units of the British Expeditionary Force. They would be ferried across the channel, and they would just take up some position on the flank of the French. The British war plans literally said that it would be the French who would do most of the fighting. So we're just going to make sure that the Germans can't get around them. That's all we're going to do. How the hell do you win a war doing this? Well, that's where the Navy comes in. While there would be few boots on the ground, where England really intended on flexing its muscle was taking advantage of a strategy that they developed that helped beat Napoleon. They had the largest navy on earth. So their plan in 1914 was to literally establish a blockade. They were going to put a blockade in the North Sea and deny the flow of goods to Germany. Their primary focus was to engage on an economic war, not a military, boots on the ground, physical active war. So, the French are going to do most of the dying. So are the Russians on the other side. But the Brits, that's fine. Our empire will be secure. But we'll use what we have. We'll use our banking. You know, we'll have our factories making bullets for the French and guns and all the rest. And in the end, England will emerge not only victorious, but unscathed. Because that's how they beat Napoleon. And that's how they would beat the Germans. The same exact way. But truth be told, there was a huge flaw that the Brits didn't take into account. The biggest flaw was the catch-22. In order to have their economy flowing, you had to have boys working in the factories to keep the goods being produced. But you know who cannot work factory presses and machines?
Women?
No, you can put a woman in there eventually, but not initially.
Children?
No, yeah, well, you need boys in the factories. You know who can't run factories? The boys when you put them in uniform and you ship them across the sea. Because when you put a boy in uniform and ship him across the sea, what could happen to him? He could die. And how many factory machines can a dead boy operate?
Zero.
Zero. The biggest flaw that this plan had was they could not become entangled. Because if they became entangled, that would impact their capacity. And guess who didn't tell the British generals? The politicians. The politicians didn't talk to the British generals. So the British generals, their focus was winning the war by any means. They wanted an immediate expansion of the army. They wanted an immediate expansion of the boots on the ground. Heck, within days of the war, the German army called for 500,000 volunteers. And guess where all those boys came from? They came from the factories. And they went down and they put the uniform on to go serve for God and country. Overnight, workers became soldiers. And as a result, industrial capacity began to decline. So with every single bullet, the business as usual begins to die. Questions. And by the way, the same was true all across Europe. The Russian plans, the Austrian plans, they didn't matter. Every strategy that they had in 1914 would prove to be useless by October, November, December 1914. And the same was true everywhere. Why? Well, because, like I said, in the instance of the British, they were planning for the previous war, not the current war. The French, oh, we're going to win just because. The Germans, oh, we're going to be able to sweep through Belgium. The Belgians aren't going to stop us. Everything's going to work. And then we're going to be able to do an about face. Yeah, that's going to work. How many times have you ever seen that happen in the history of the world? Where a nation was able to fight a two-front war, knock out one enemy like that, and then immediately reposition. It's never happened, but it sounds good on paper, no? The biggest problem was is that these were just plans. They didn't actually take the time to gather intelligence. They didn't know what their enemies can do. They didn't know what their allies were willing to do. And they didn't even know really what they could do. They just said, let's make a plan. To make matters worse, they had no appreciation for the technology that they were putting in the hands of their soldiers. They didn't take into account that unlike the Franco-Prussian War, where there was about 75,000 men on the German side and like 90,000 men on the French side, these are armies of millions. They didn't take into account the terrain. Literally, imagine having a flat piece of paper that says, we're going to go straight and there's no obstacles, only to have the soldiers show up and, wait, there's a mountain in the way. But it's not on paper, so it can't be there. Or rivers, or forests, or swamps. Heck, there were times both armies marched, and they marched into villages that weren't even on any map. How do you fight and plan based on that? And another thing they didn't take into account. I saw the hardest, whenever it happens, I always make sure I put the news on because I want to be able to see it. This morning, no, it was yesterday morning, the father of one of the soldiers that died in the Iranian strike, the terrorist strike, was on TV. And he was talking about his daughter. It's the hardest thing you can see. But a parent has to talk about the loss of their child on the battlefield. How many parents? How many parents are impacted when train loads full of coffins pull into the station? What is the people going to say? Do you think it's possible that, oh, this is great, honor, glory, let's fight for love of country? It's all good until the body bags start coming home and you start having the military funerals. That's when, doesn't matter who wins, becomes part of the conversation. Just end the fucking war. Because at the end of the day, a dead loved one is more important than any battlefield victory in some new award or ribbon that a general is going to get. And as if that was not bad enough, I told you, these leaders were fighting wars as if it was the 19th century. They stuck to classical concepts of war. They believed that they could simply outflank, outmaneuver the enemy, that they could envelop and destroy. That's how the Prussians were able to knock the French out of the Franco-Prussian War so quick. They took their units, enveloped all three French armies, and each French army, including the one commanded by Napoleon himself, surrendered. Well, all of the combatants believed they could do this, that it would just happen. But again, they didn't take into consideration the size of the armies. They didn't take into consideration the capacity of the nations. They also didn't take into capacity the stubbornness not to negotiate. Because if we could take this one extra town, we could have a better bargaining chip at the negotiating table. They didn't see it. Instead, what did they believe? We'll just send over another unit. We'll just put more guns in their hands. We'll make sure there's more bullets. They believed that they could will victory. Why? Because I'm not exaggerating. Because that's the way war had been fought for 70 years. The last major war in Europe was the Crimean War, which took place in 1853. That one was a long one, but that's just because the Russians were fighting the Turks. I mean, it was a mess. But other than the Crimean War, you had, the Second War of Italian Independence that lasted a whole whopping 2 months. You had the Second Schleswig War that lasted 8 months. You had the Austrian-Prussian War that was 7 weeks. You had the Third War of Italian Independence. That was an 8-week war. Franco-Prussian War. Technically, it lasted 6 months, but truth be told, it only lasted 6 weeks. You had the Russo-Turkish War, which we talked about. That was a 10-month war. And then you had the two Balkan Wars, 8 months and 5 weeks, respectively. They believed this would be quick. You send your army in, you outmaneuver the enemy, you take a little bit of territory, and then you negotiate. Because that's how all wars ended. Heck, even the Russo-Japanese War ended through mediation and diplomacy. That's how all wars ended. So that's how this is going to end. So the goal is you send your army out as quick as you can, quickly take as much position as you can, hold on to it, and then the diplomats will come in. And then you'll give a little bit, they'll get a little bit, and everyone will be happy. And whoever has the most lands doesn't have to pay. Because that's how it had been done. At some point, both sides would look for a ceasefire. Then they would hammer out a treaty. Land would be redistributed, and the technical people who got the less land had to pay for everything. That's the way it had all been for 70 plus years. That's how they believed this would end, because that's all they knew. But you know what they didn't anticipate? This was different. This was a war that had no end in sight. Because the nations needed to keep fighting. Because the longer they fought, the more they could achieve. Also, the longer they fought, the new weapons that could be developed, the new technology. But you know what they didn't anticipate? The bigger guns, the more lethal gas, tanks, airplanes, bombs, mines. Well, that all equals more death. So truth be told, World War I, as we're going to see, would become nothing but a catch-22. You needed to fight to outmaneuver the enemy, but the longer you fight, the more chances are the enemy's going to develop some new weapon that needs to be countered, because that new weapon is only going to result in killing more. But when you kill more, that means you're going to have to send more men, and thus you're going to have to continue to fight. The goal wasn't just about winning, it was about breaking the enemy. If you could produce the most weapons, you could have an advantage on the battlefield. But of course, you needed to be able to get those weapons to the battlefield. So if you had infrastructure, transportation capacity, you could overwhelm the enemy. And by the way, the more guns you can get to the battlefield, that means you can send more troops to the battlefield. Wave after wave of fresh troops to fire the nice new shiny guns with those limitless supply of bullets. But you gotta be careful. Gotta be careful. You can't send too much. Because if you try sending too many soldiers on too many trains, you're gonna end up with traffic jams. And you're not gonna be able to actually get the supplies to the battlefield. So you only can send just enough. Not enough to completely overwhelm the enemy. Just enough to keep things going until the next tool comes. I'm almost done. We're going to go a little late because I want to finish.
The problem was the industrial capacity.
This is the biggest thing that they didn't see because, like I said, this was not a war like anyone had ever seen before. The guns could shoot longer. Machine guns could shoot more. Plus, they started using things like barbed wire, gas, more powerful explosives, smokeless powder, accurate artillery. That literally changed warfare forever. So we'll often hear that this war was led by idiots. But the truth be told is no. Technology drove the war. And because it was so lethal, it actually forced the men to have to dig down. Because if you didn't put your head in the ground, it would be blown off. And the problem is once you're entrenched, you're fighting from a static position. The enemy's fighting from a static position, and now there's no fluidity, there's no mobility. You're here, they're there, you shoot at them, they'll shoot at you, and that's it. That ultimately would become conditions on the Western Front. So one of the reasons why the war continued for so long was it was unwinnable. If you took your men out of the trenches, they died. It was easy as that. Last bit of analysis. Traditionally, warfare was shaped by an interplay. What was your firepower? What was your capacity? And how quickly could you reposition yourselves? Both impacted the battlefield. Traditionally, though, when firepower is in the ascent, the war becomes static. If both sides have more firepower, they become more lethal, and thus it's more dangerous to move. Because again, you're more likely to get your head blown apart. So the result is very simple. Very simple. Of course, if it's in the reverse, you have a fluid war. And this was the expectation. The expectation was it would be the reverse. That it would be fast movement. And thus it would be safe to quickly reposition. And thus there would be no trenches. There would be no lines. But the truth of the matter is there were so many guns at such high rates of firepower. There was so much death that everything slowed down. Everything became bunched up. Everything became crowded. Because that was the only way to survive. So, when we start talking about the trench system, I want you to remember this. This was not developed for shits and giggles. It was developed out of necessity. You had to dig down. Yes, the natural response is to dig holes. Again, I've never been in combat. I've never had anyone shoot at me. But I imagine if I was standing here and I start hearing the sound of bees, the bullets flying by you, I'm going to jump to the ground. It's a natural human condition. But of course, there's so many. The natural tendency is to want to dig deeper. And so what ended up happening was millions of men digging trenches that stretched from the English Channel all the way to the Swiss border. Not because they wanted to, because they had to. Because if they didn't, they would die. And what did the politicians keep saying? Send more boys, send more bullets. It seemingly would never end. But we'll deal with that later. All right, now here's the problem with the fact that I'm done. I'm done for the first exam. Kind of told you the exam was coming. I just didn't think I would actually get done today. But we're done. So, you guys pick when you want your exam. Would you like to take it tomorrow on Friday? Would you like to take it on Saturday? Would you like to take it on Sunday?
I got a question. Is it on in-person?
It's online. No, it's online. That's would you like to take it on Sunday?
Yeah.
Or Monday. I want a show of hands.
Tomorrow.
How many people want tomorrow? Three. How many people want it on Saturday? Four. How many people want it on Sunday? One. How many people want it on Monday? All right, here's what's going to happen. It's mostly a multiple choice test. It's based on everything that we covered up to this point. It will open up at 8 a.m. on Saturday morning. You have the entire day to do it. So you just got to remember to take the exam before 11:59 p.m. on Saturday night. I will send out a reminder through Engage. So you have an hour to do it. Make sure you're on stable Wi-Fi. And the biggest thing that you need to remember is you can't go back. One question on the screen at a time. No going back. If you skip a question, it's wrong. All right?
Sure.
Two essays. One essay is for extra credit. Each one, you pick one of the three choices within. All the directions will be sent out.
Have a good day.
Good luck. Remind me I owe you guys 10 minutes.